And we have with us Phil Bieberfeld, who is the dean of the Philadelphia Kollel, which is located in Balakinwood, and it's the Kollel is the Philadelphia Kollel is a institute for advanced Talmudic learning, which has been a very important organization in Philadelphia for the past 10 or so years. And he's a well-known speaker and expert in Jewish law in Philadelphia. And we're very honored to have him to speak again over here for this yearly presentation. But before Bieberfeld will present the Jewish perspective, the Jewish legal perspective on fraud, we also have the privilege to have as our speaker for today, Alan Liss, who is the managing partner of Brenner and Brenner, who specializes in bankruptcy and finance here in Center City. And we're very honored to have Alan to present the American legal perspective on the subject of fraud. So with no further ado, I'd like to have Alan speak first, followed by Rabbi Bieberfeld. Thank you very much for coming. And also, again, as I always say, make sure to fill out those forms and give them to Hope as you're leaving today with your...
Okay. Thank you, Rabbi. Everybody has a handout, I believe. It's circulated around the table. So as you're eating, you can read and listen. Reuven brings his computer to his friend Shimon to have it fixed. Shimon examines the computer and concludes that it is not fixable. Instead of trashing it, Shimon asks Reuven if he can keep it for parts. Reuven agrees. A few weeks later, Reuven happens to enter Shimon's shop and sees his old computer being used by Shimon. "Hey, that's my computer." "It is indeed," admits Shimon. "After you left, my friend, another computer geek, showed me that I can fix your computer. Since you said I can keep it, I did." Is Shimon allowed to keep Reuven's computer? Anyway, I'm sure it's happened to me a number of times where you would bring something to someone, you leave a car to be fixed, and you get all kinds of hidden guesses and estimates as to the price, the cost, what's right, what's wrong. Stuff we don't know. Things that are just happening, and it's beyond our wildest imagination why you would get a price or a quote or an opinion of repair, and then later someone is using or has taken or as now your possessions. And so what do you do? We try to label this entire discussion on fraud, but actually fraud is such a it's a window of different actions that take place that I had to be a little bit more expansive in how we're going to cloak this particular fact scenario. So as you look through the handout, you'll see other theories of recovery, which we can talk about and just discuss in a rather broad sense. The elements of fraud, as you see on the second page, is that there's a representation of an existing fact, the materiality of it, and its falsity. So if we go back to the factual scenario, what exactly was Reuven hoping for when he brought his computer over to Shimon? He was hoping that Shimon would fix it, and he would pay for it, and he would take the computer and work with his computer, with his piece. Did he intend to leave it as garbage or trash or parts, as Shimon suggested he would want to use it? What was the intent of either of their minds? Are these guys friends? It seems to me that as you read through this fact scenario, it's one friend with another friend, a shop owner. Does that raise the level of expectations on one or both of the parties? Any thoughts, any ideas? Anyone? Did Reuven have an expectation that Shimon would be using this computer? That the computer would be fixed? Maybe yes, maybe no. But anyway, as you try to determine exactly what your remedies are, or as attorneys, what we try to tell our clients we need to know the value of the material. We need to know exactly what was our expectations at the outset, and we were and what we were expecting after the fact. Well, it can be argued that Reuven certainly was expecting a usable, workable computer. He certainly wasn't expecting to see it up and running. I mean, this is exactly what he wanted done in the first place. So, arguably, Shimon now has Reuven's possession. Was there a meeting of the minds at the outset? Did the parties agree that this would be kept, not turned back, despite what happens down the road? In other words, the computer was fixed, not returned. What exactly can Reuven do? Well, I've also discussed, along with potential fraud aspects, conversion, which is more of a voluntary act by one person. It's a tort of strict liability when someone wrongfully uses property of another. The elements that we can discuss with conversion are very similar to theft. However, if Reuven makes a demand for the computer, is Shimon obligated or required to give it back under American jurisprudence? There must be clear legal ownership, a right to possession of the property at the time of the conversion, which probably happened, and the shopkeeper, Shimon's actions here, is a wrongful act of Reuven's computer. So what happened here? Was the property converted to his own use? Did he fail to tell Reuven your computer was fixed? Did he have a duty or did he have an obligation to tell Reuven, I fixed it, come and get it, there's a cost? He did nothing. Could there have been a gift made? Did Reuven perhaps donate this computer to the welfare of Shimon? Was he entitled to, was Shimon entitled to keep it once he suggested to Reuven this cannot be fixed? The fact that it was fixable, does it change what the party's original intentions were or understanding at the outset? These are all different theories. Now, obviously, a used computer, we're talking perhaps a smaller monetary value, but expand on it. Make it a computer, make it a $20,000, $50,000 piece of equipment that otherwise has a very low intrinsic scrap value, but in a fixed state or condition, it's worth $50,000, $60,000, $70,000. Does that change Reuven's chance of recovery, either of the property or for monetary damages? Was there a gift? In the daily practice, Reuven probably has an action with the courts to have the property seized, then determined by a court of law exactly whose property it is, what the rights are of the parties. This is a replevin action where a writ of seizure would issue. This we do actually here in Philadelphia. Sheriff will go out, seize the property, seize the person who has the property wrongfully, and it'll be held for court on the merits of ownership and other damages which potentially come into play. Does Reuven have an action here in replevin if this material is not turned back to him? He probably does. He could file the writ and have his day in court. I threw in, just for discussion's sake, theft by deception, which is criminal in nature. It deals with monetary amounts, just to suggest that if there was a willful undertaking by Shimon, if there was a willful failure to notify Reuven that, hey, I fixed your computer, it's working, if all this happened and he failed to turn it back or turn it over, perhaps there's even a criminal action that could have been brought by
by Reuven to get it back.
So, all in all, if we go back to the original fact scenario, there seems to have been a lot of discussion between Reuven and Shimon as to what the intent of the parties were. How many think that Reuven has an opportunity or a chance to get the computer back? Just a show of hands. Does anyone feel that there's a wrongful taking by Shimon, that there was an intent to defraud Reuven at the outset? Does anyone feel that? Does anyone think there was a gift made by Reuven, which potentially gives no rise at all to any recovery by Reuven? What makes you think there was a gift?
He didn't ask for anything in return. He just,
He agreed to let him keep it for parts.
For parts. But see, it's really, parts can be the casing of the computer and the whole bit. I mean, in other words, he could have come in there and he said, well, you agreed to let me have it for parts. And he said, well, all I needed was, some little 2-cent thing and it's working now. And he said, I gave for parts. And that was the only thing that was wrong. So I kept it. I mean, I think because of lack of particularity, in though they left it very open, because the computer, and I'm speaking to someone who's not technologically oriented, but they're small parts and big parts, I just see it as a gift. He obviously didn't value it enough to take it with him to see if somebody else could fix it.
But he also thought
he was willing to just let his friend have it.
But he also thought it wasn't fixable. Does that change?
It wasn't fixable by this individual, and he didn't put enough of a value on it to say, well, let me see if I can get it fixed somewhere else. So he was willing to give it up, to give up any and all of its parts. He didn't say, well, you can have it, but let me keep the memory or keep the screen or whatever. I'm just willing to give it up. Rather than take it somewhere else, I
construe
it as a gift.
Anyone else agree or disagree? Yeah.
There seem to me there's two issues that you haven't really addressed. One is that it seems that both parties were operating under a mutual mistake of fact. They both believed that it was not, giving best case scenario, they both honestly believed that it wasn't repairable. Turns out that it was repairable. So there's a mutual mistake and equity was going to allow for a transfer back in that case. Also, there's an expert there who's fixing things and makes a negligent representation that it's not fixable. I think that's another basis for a recovery back.
Okay. Yeah. So it's not a gift.
It may have been a gift, but I think it's a gift made by a mutual mistake, and so therefore you can set it aside.
So the mistake turns it around.
That's correct.
Okay, so anyone else feel it's a gift or not a gift, or yes?
It's been a long time since law school, but I recall a theory of conditional gift. The gift was on the condition that it was not fixable and he was using it for parts. The condition fails because it is fixable, and therefore it ceases to be a gift. And then we have theft by conversion because he doesn't help it.
Does anyone think that there's a potential fraud that took place here between Shimon and Reuven? That he totally purposely misstated, or had a duty upon learning that it was fixable, getting back to Reuven and advising him? Does that lay the groundwork for a potential fraud? Anyone feel that way?
Even if there was, how would you prove that? The problem there would be the proof. Let's say that was true. Yeah, there also some analysis. But you'd have to prove Shimon's state of mind. Did he know that it was fixable when he talked to Reuven initially? Based on the facts that we have here, you can get some more facts that would be something else, but based on what we have, it's this is, you know, was your presentation to the court? You might get Rule 50 or something.
Right, right. How about damages? Might Reuven be entitled to any monetary damages for the length of time Shimon been using the computer? If we can conclude that the computer goes back to Reuven, is he also entitled to money? It's a thought. It's just these cases can bring on damages, special damages for the actual value at the beginning versus the actual value at the end, plus the timeout that the product or the computer in this case has actually been missing or out of service. Now, what about just Shimon being a mensch and just giving the computer back? I would be remiss probably to ask the rabbi.
Well,
not to ask the rabbi that maybe just based on the facts of potential friendship here, which it seems to be, that Shimon should do the right thing and just give the computer back. And
yeah, but the problem is you're discussing the American legal. I don't know if the American obligates you to be a mensch. So,
but you can still be a mensch, right?
Yes, yeah, sure.
So I think with that, Rabbi,
a flash picture. He took a flashback.
Oh.
Yeah, it was
light and struck. Be a mensch.
Yeah, be a mensch, right. So anyway, that's pretty much the long and the short of the fact situation here, and I think we've touched on and probably talked about the different causes of actions and the potential remedies and potential outcome. Does anyone think that Shimon
about conversion? Did you? I was out in the room for this.
Mentioned it. Yeah.
But doesn't that fit? The way you define it out here is that it doesn't require any intent.
Correct.
Conversion requires no element of dishonesty. So why isn't it conversion when he learns the computer's at least some conversion when he learns the computer's fixable and he doesn't call his friend to return the computer?
We did touch on that. Does he have a duty to call Reuven and
5 seconds? Okay. Sorry, I missed the key point.
He should have called. Perhaps he should have called Reuven. Okay, Rabbi. So tell me, what does the Talmud say about
this case? Yeah. So thank you, Mr. Liss. I think that was good, a presentation to understand different angles that, number one, what is the mindset of the two people here involved, if we're talking about a small claims court, but as you was mentioned, it could be talking about something that's just much more valuable, and how would we look at it? Do we go into the minds of the people and say, well, he was actually gifting it? Question to that, the gentleman to my left argued very well that it was all under a mistaken assumption, and both parties were mistaken, and maybe the fact that Reuven was the one who put the mistaken idea into his friend Shimon's mind, or it's the other way around, Shimon put it into Reuven's mind, maybe that should play a role in the case as well. So before I present you a little law from the Talmud, let me just ask a question as follows. What happens if you see your neighbor carrying out his $400 printer and puts it out on the side the day before garbage pickup? And he puts it out there, and you wait till he goes into his house, not because you're worried that you're stealing from him, but you don't want him seeing rummaging around in his garbage. So he goes back into the house, and then you take the computer, and you you're good with your hands. You fix up the printer, works as not as good as new, but it's certainly a very well used printer. Okay, would anybody say that I have a legal or ethical obligation to call them up and say, I just fixed your printer, come on over and pick it up, no delivery charge?
No.
Right?
No.
Certainly not. Certainly not. So, using that example, really the Talmud will look at it like this. The fellow who brought in the computer, Reuven, right? Was there a point in time where Reuven threw out his computer? Was there a point in time where Reuven said, you know what, it's not fixable anymore, it's not mine anymore. He relinquishes ownership rights over this. If that's the case, it's really free for all. Anybody could take it. It's as if it's tantamount to him disposing his printer, which he thinks doesn't work anymore, onto the side of the street. And anybody could take it. And if lo and behold, all he was, he had to tighten a little screw, no one would say there's an obligation to return it. So this is not exactly the same case, because here we're talking about he didn't have knowledge of it unless the technician, his friend Shimon, told him that it's irreparable. So the Gemara gives the following, Talmud gives the following scenario. If an animal would, God forbid, kill a human being, the Torah states clearly that the animal has to be put to death. Several months ago, the big whale, Shamu, killed its trainer, one of its trainers, right? The Talmud would say, you put it to death. Okay? Where does it go? SeaWorld? Right? Okay. SeaWorld opted not to, because there would be obviously a big financial loss for them. And it seems like the family of the victim here was, pardoned Shamu, and they let it live. But if an animal, it could be a dog, it could be someone's pet tiger, kills a person, has to be put to death. Okay? What happens? Two witnesses come to the Jewish court. Two witnesses, we just saw there was this dog who mauled a person, killed it, and we saw it happen. They claimed this in a Jewish court. And after cross-examinations of the witnesses, the Beis Din, the Court of Jewish Law, concludes, indeed, this animal has to be put to death. As soon as they give that ruling, two other witnesses come into the Beis Din. This is very common for those that have Talmudic knowledge. Two other witnesses come and say, you know, these two first two witnesses, there's no way they could have said that this dog killed somebody, because the time that they say, the date and the place of when this killing happened, they actually were with us in Atlantic City. And they said this took place in Center City, Philadelphia. They were with us in Atlantic City. And indeed, it comes out that the first two witnesses were false. The Talmud says that at that point, whoever wants to seize that dog, whoever wants to take it and take it as a pet, or if it was a bull and someone wanted to take it, a farmer wanted to take it to work on its farm, or someone wanted to take it for its meat, anyone has rights to take it. Why should that be? Why is it free for all? There was an owner here. Why is it free for all now?
Once the animal was sentenced, it's as if it was dead already, I guess.
But what does that have to do with the owner?
His rights were severed.
His rights. And do we have a right to sever his rights?
The Beis Din does.
The Beis Din could just seize his property? Well, they can only seize the property up to the point where they finish adjudicating the case. But now that's done, and they really should return it. So we have to go a step further, and the Talmud says, because as soon as the owner hears that his dog or his animal has to be killed, he relinquishes his ownership rights to it. If you would hear him speaking, or if he actually verbalized this, he says, well, it's time to get a new pet, because my dog that I was so close to all these years is going to be killed. Essentially, he relinquished his rights to that. And once he relinquished his rights to it, it's as if he took his printer and put it onto the sidewalk. He's given up ownership rights. And therefore, whoever wants to take that printer, or in this case, whoever wants to take that animal, can take that animal, because he has given up his ownership rights on it. Okay? Does that make sense?
Well, that's based on somebody reading the mind of this man, right?
So that, we can make an assumption, that as many times we do in the Talmud, there are cases where we have to indeed read the mind of the person. And we'll go by the assumption of, let's say, the majority of people. Once a person knows that his dog is on death row, you know, he's on his way to, or let's say we see he's already going to the pet shop to buy a new animal. And as we know, he relinquished his rights to it.
But you talk to a lot of dog owners. I think that they might have a whole different perspective to that.
They may hope what?
They you know, a lot of people have dogs. They love them as part of their family.
Sure,
they're not giving them up until they're gone totally. You know, so. Mm-hmm. It just seems strange to me that they can make a, you know, a generalization in a specific situation like that.
Okay.
Well,
okay.
It also seems that the basis for understanding that the dog was the one who mauled the person is based on those two witnesses that are the false witnesses. So it doesn't seem to make sense to me. Maybe it wasn't this dog. Maybe it was a different dog that had created the harm. So why should this owner lose their dog because there's been an accusation, but that it was a false accusation?
It was entirely false. In the end, when the facts are revealed, turns out that the whole story is fabricated by the first two witnesses. So why should that be? So we see from here, according to this Talmudic statement here, we see from here that if one relinquishes his ownership rights over an item, whether it's an item, whether it's a pet, it seems that we take that. And until he then acquires that item again, his relinquishing of those rights remain as a fact. And if he's relinquished, even though it was done under a false premise.
So what's the vehicle to reacquire the rights?
So let's say he was in court that day because he was so close to his pet, he wanted to see what's happening. And then as soon as he sees that the second pair of witnesses came and falsified the first ones, he sees the whole story was made up. He said, "I knew it the whole time. My dog would never have done such a thing." And then man and dog are reunited once again. And then he could acquire it again. He has the right as anybody else does.
But it puts burden on him to do the acquiring.
Correct. So it seems, even though we're saying we would not have come to this conclusion, but relinquishing ownership rights under a false premise seems to stay as the law. Okay? The question is asked as follows. Here's another law. If I'm a judge and two people come with a monetary disagreement and I rule in favor of one of them and I say, okay, Mr. A, you have to pay Mr. B the $1,000. Indeed, he was right. You owe $1,000 to Mr. B. And Mr. A pays Mr. B $1,000. Okay? They leave the court, and my friend comes and says, you know, I didn't want to embarrass you in front of everybody, but actually, he takes out a big volume of the Talmud and turns to the page and says, look, right here it says that you misruled. You ruled incorrectly. So I say, oy vey, I ruled incorrectly. That's right. All right, call back the parties in. And we have to call the parties back in. And I say, my apologies, I made a mistake, but my colleague pointed it out. And indeed, we reviewed the case and, nope, Mr. B, you have to give back the $1,000 to Mr. A. And that's the rule. Question is as follows. When Mr. A and Mr. B left the court just 20 minutes earlier, and Mr. A had to pay the $1,000, did Mr. A not relinquish his ownership rights on that $1,000? So let it be that the judge made a mistake. But it's too late. Now he relinquished his rights. And even if you relinquished your rights under a mistaken premise, did we not say that becomes the reality then? And he relinquished his rights. He's not the owner of that $1,000 anymore. So party B should be able to keep the money, not by virtue of winning the case, but by virtue of this person essentially threw out his $1,000. It's like a person who thought that the $1,000 bills that he has, someone tells him, oh, you know, those are counterfeit. Oh, they are? I thought they were real. No, they're not real. Okay. Throws out in the garbage. Someone comes along and picks it up. Because that fellow made a mistake, he should get it back. Legally, the person who picks it up, it's his. So he, party A, Mr. A, handed over the $1,000 to Mr. B, and mistakenly thought that he had to relinquish these $1,000. But yet here we say, no, the parties have to come back, and we review the case again. What's the difference between the dog going out to be killed and the judge who ruled mistakenly?
Where the judge rules mistakenly, Mr. A is compelled to pay the money. In civil law, it would be a court order that he has to comply with. Whereas in the dog case, the dog hasn't yet been killed, so I guess there's some room for maneuvering here.
What does the Talmud say if A refuses to pay? Based on his belief that he's right.
Okay. So he did pay. In the end, he did pay. That was the case. Then we called them back in. But I think what you're both saying is like this. In the case of the owner of the dog, he had no idea of the facts of the case. He doesn't know. He was called up and said, listen, you have to bring your dog into court. He has a day in court. And didn't know why. And then finds it afterwards because witnesses testified to his animal being a vicious animal. And therefore, we have to lock it up or kill it to take it out of society's harm. In the case of the two litigants coming into the court of Jewish law, party A, Mr. A, knows that he's right. He knows that Mr. B was lying through his teeth the whole time. And that's why the judge ruled in his favor. So he really never relinquished his rights. He never gave up hope about those $1,000. He says, you know, I'm going to leave today, but I'm going to go home and ask my rabbi about it, and I'm going to bring other witnesses to prove my case. So he actually never relinquished rights to his hoping to get that back. And therein lies one difference between these two scenarios. Okay? So if that's the case, go back to our original scenario that was presented today. Reuven brings in his computer to Shimon, and Shimon tells him, not fixable. At that moment, when he leaves the store, Reuven, and says, you can just keep it for its parts, does he give up the rights to that computer or not?
Yeah.
It certainly seems he did. Whether he actually wanted to give it as a gift, or whether he just said, well, them's the breaks, you know, I lost my computer, it broke, it's not repairable, I gotta buy a new one. He has given up full ownership rights on it. And therefore, really, whoever wants to take it can take it. Now, like mentioned before, I don't think we assume this was a case of fraud, that he deliberately tried to fool his friend Shimon. The technician didn't try to deliberately fool his friend. He made an honest assessment on the computer. He felt it was not fixable, and that was his opinion and was accepted by the customer. So if that was the case, it certainly would be allowed to keep it. It's not like the case of two parties, the two litigants, who one was ruled against. It's not the same as that, because in that case, he actually knew. But there's a different answer to this sort of contradiction of these two cases. Again, case number one is two witnesses testified an animal has to be put to death because it's a danger to society. And after the Beis Din ruled, after the court ruled it has to be killed, then it was uncovered the fact that this was not true. And in that case, we say the owner has given up rights to it, he's relinquished his ownership, and anybody can seize the animal, anybody can take it. As opposed to this other case where a judge ruled in favor of party B, made party A pay party B, and then can call the case back. And we said, what's the difference of the case? Why don't we say that the fact that Mr. A paid $1,000 to Mr. B, he's essentially giving up on his ownership of that $1,000. Okay? So another possible answer to distinguish between these two cases is as follows. In the case of the two litigants, the one party is right and one party is wrong. And each of them know that. And it is one of them is lying. One of them is not disclosing all of the information of the case. And the person who is lying, therefore, is causing the loser to have to pay him. And in this case, Mr. B was the winner. The court ruled in favor of Mr. B. But Mr. B, because he lied, he caused Mr. A to have to pay him. And because he caused Mr. A to have to pay him, we view that as almost Mr. B stealing that money from Mr. A. Even though it was done by a judge, but it was done under some mistaken notion that Mr. B is correct, and therefore we call back the case. As opposed to the case of the animal, no one was causing the owner of the dog to give up his rights to the dog. No one was causing him to do that. It was just based on an assumption that he thought his dog has to be killed.
The owner didn't want to give up the dog, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he had two liars on the witness stand under your hypothesis. Why does the owner have to relinquish his ownership of the dog under those circumstances?
He doesn't have to.
Says it in the Talmud?
Well, he doesn't have to do that. Mm-hmm. But we are assuming that he automatically does, which was... this gentleman asked that. Why do we make that generalization? Why do we assume that to be? I guess it's arguable to say maybe you have to ask each person. But then again, since most cases of the rule of the court would be executed immediately, no pun intended, but they would kill the animal immediately. So we'll assume, and we'll safely assume, that as soon as he hears that ruling, he relinquishes his ownership rights.
Maybe that's what he's saying is, why isn't it stealing because the two false witnesses stole the dog from him by their false, is it that they wouldn't get the benefit of it? In other words, is that maybe the distinction?
Well, the truth is, those two witnesses we have to deal with.
Right.
And they in the end, they do have to... Right.
Did they not steal
they will have
ownership?
To pay up.
In a way, didn't they steal ownership of the dog by their falseness, similar to how the other thing was stolen? Or, as I said, is it maybe that they won't get the benefit of the deal?
Right, because they're not ending up with the dog. Some third party is then ending up with the dog. And that third party never caused the owner of the dog to relinquish his rights. As opposed to Mr. A and Mr. B, Mr. B caused Mr. A to have to...
And he was the beneficiary.
Transfer, and he was the beneficiary of that. So then if that's the case, let's go back to our scenario. Reuven walks into the computer shop, and Shimon tells him that it's not fixable. So in essence, Shimon is causing Reuven to therefore say, well, I have to relinquish my ownership rights. Essentially, that's what he's saying by saying, you can just keep it. So perhaps we view that, but since it was caused by the beneficiary of it, then maybe in that case, that will be like our second scenario, where you have to call back the two litigants and review the case. Because since the one who benefited over here was the one who also caused the person to mistakenly relinquish his rights. As opposed to the case where the animal, no one caused him, the beneficiary did not cause the owner of the dog to relinquish his rights. Yes? Yeah, yes, okay, so that's true. I should really clarify that. The idea of the one benefiting is that we view it as almost that they are stealing. The party that caused the mistaken mindset, who then benefited it, is that we view that item as if they stole that item. So in the case of the two litigants, since Mr. B lied and caused Mr. A to have to sort of relinquish his rights on the $1,000, we view it as if it came to him through stealing. And that's the possibility by the computer case. Perhaps Shimon, who caused Reuven to relinquish his rights under a mistaken premise, perhaps he should be considered as if he stole the computer and as it came to him in illegal terms and therefore would have to give it back. Not just, right, it's not just a benefit, any benefit.
When would it be considered that Shimon stole it? when he later learned he could fix it?
If we would assume it to be this more like the second case with the two litigants, so at what point would he...
At the outset, he didn't steal it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a fact that it couldn't be fixed.
Right. So I think you're making an argument the other way. I say, because you could look at it, the case as, since Shimon is the one causing Reuven to make this mistake and relinquish his rights, on the other side you could say he's not causing it to do it by any malicious intent. He gave him an honest assessment, which everybody agreed upon was an honest assessment. And therefore maybe that's not considered as if it came to him illegally and he's stealing it. That's correct. I think that's that even if we assume this second answer, or the second way of reconciling the contradiction between these two cases, it's debatable still, does this fit into the case of the two litigants?
Doesn't the
Mora
describe the motive of the two false witnesses in the first case?
No.
So yes. I'm struggling a little bit, what is the benefit in the first case with the dog? Why did you make the decision? What is the benefit of having the dog be open to anyone taking, as opposed to just simply returning the dog to the owner, given that the owner is an innocent, similar to Mr. A is an innocent? Why is there a distinction?
Well, in Talmudic law, we try to make things very black and white. We feel bad for this person, that's clear. The Torah tells us, you have someone who's very wealthy, and he's in court against someone who is destitute, and the Torah warns the judge. Don't show any favoritism to the destitute one because you feel bad, or because the rich fellow over here because you feel pressured. We have to view it purely from a black and white standpoint in terms of who is the legal owner right over here.
So that's why I prefaced
this whole discussion with the case of someone who mistakenly threw out his expensive printer because he thought it doesn't work. Now, would Talmud law say I'm obligated to return it to him because I tightened the screw? And now I got it to work?
But it seems a little different because the person who's putting the computer out has a certain state of mind when they do that, as opposed to the man with the dog who doesn't have a mistaken state of mind. He's just following the rules.
Right. Right. So I think that's the novel idea over here, that we all agree with. That is certainly a novelty, the fact that if somebody relinquishes ownership rights based on a false premise, that is still legally binding.
Except.
And there's no difference. Someone tells me, hey, all the cash that you're carrying around, it's all counterfeit. You might have just thrown it away. Right? And I do. That's legally binding. I relinquished my ownership rights. Now, I do agree... with Alan, that from a mensch perspective, it certainly should go back to the owner. From a mensch perspective, even the computer technician should say, "Hey, it was really, there was a way to fix it, and I should give back the computer." I do agree with that, Rabbi Coleman.
Why would not be considered relinquishing ownership on counterfeit money as opposed to real cash? Or relinquish the ownership on an item which I believe to be broken, and the reality this is not such an item.
Because you have to relinquish ownership on something tangible, on an item.
But this is that, well, relinquish ownership on an item which is on an item which I believe to be something different than it really is. And this is not an example of counterfeit money. So you're telling me it's counterfeit money, so that's what I think it is. So I'm relinquishing ownership on counterfeit cash. That's not really what it is. So I'm not relinquishing ownership on real money. I'm relinquishing ownership on counterfeit money, which is not what it really is. So now I discover afterwards it's really counterfeit money.
Well, it's really not
real cash.
Mm-hmm.
So I never relinquished ownership on that.
Right. Yeah. This is like the sugya of Yish Betos.
Okay.
Right. Someone gives up ownership under a mistaken premise, and that we see clearly from this little passage in the Talmud, Krisus Daf Chav Dalet, that tells us with the case of the pet, or the in the case of the Talmud, it's an ox who gored someone and killed a person, has to be put to death. And in those few moments when they then falsified the witnesses, we assume already that the owner gave up rights to the animal. And once he gives rights to the animal, we consider that already binding in terms of his loss of ownership.
And it's different than the judge who gives, the person who gives up the money under judge's orders.
So we had two distinctions over here. We had two distinctions. Yeah, no, we don't have a test afterwards, by the way. Don't worry.
Why is that different again?
We had two distinctions. Distinction number one is that in the case of two litigants in court, we assume he never relinquished his ownership rights to the money he had to pay by court order because he knew the truth. And therefore he was hoping that he would still be able to come back and appeal the case. And that's distinction number one. Distinction number two is that if the fact that he had to relinquish rights to somebody and that person ended up benefiting from that, could be the one who benefited from that is considered as if it came to his hand in an illegal way, sort of in a form of stealing, and therefore he doesn't become the legal owner, and therefore would have to give it back.
There's flaws in both the giver and the recipient.
Correctly.
So would it be different if the witnesses, the false witnesses, if they were the ones who, you know, claimed the dog and went away?
Ah, yes. Yes.
Right.
Good. That's right. So that would be a Gemara cup already. See?
Yeah.
That's what it would be. Right. If they seized the dog, so since they caused the owner to relinquish and therefore it came to them in an illegal way, we would then obligate them to give it back. Correct.
So from the Talmud's perspective, it seems that the distinction number one, the mindset of the individual, is really the key to this whole thing. Once that person makes it, doesn't matter pretty much what happens otherwise. Once he makes that distinction, I don't want this, even if it's mistaken or whatever, it's gone from this talent point of view.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And as the if we knew, the Talmud gives a slightly different case about the animal being put to death, and in that case, the owner knew that it was false. Right. The owner knew that the witnesses are false witnesses. Now, he couldn't prove it anyway. The only way he could prove it is other witnesses would come. And in that case, we say no one can seize the dog because he hasn't relinquished rights to it. Because he's still hoping, you know, until the last moment, he's still hoping that other witnesses would come and prove that his dog is innocent. Right. But otherwise, we have to go with his mindset. And if the mindset we assume he's ready to relinquish his rights to it, his ownership rights, then that becomes the facts on the ground, and therefore he doesn't become the rightful owner anymore, and anybody could then take it. So similar to this case, once the fellow said, listen, I can't get my computer, it's broken, it's not salvageable, fine, you could keep it. At that moment he has given up his rights. So legally, based on that, legally it would seem that the computer technician may indeed keep the computer. Any further questions?
Harsh.
Okay, I guess we should just end that tomorrow evening Eitz Chaim has their annual dinner. So for those that still want to sign up, they may have a few tickets left.
All right, thank you very much.